Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is award-winning writer Adam Nicholson, and we're talking about his new book, The Seabird's Cry, The Lives and Loves of the Planet's Great Ocean Voyagers. Adam, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm starting to realize that the people who write the best books about birds are people who are not ornithologists technically, but are writers. And I think you capture, there's a way that you write that really captures the essence, the place, the experience that is unmatched by many other bird books.
Well, that is obviously music to a writer's ears, but I think ignorance is bliss in one way. And the other thing to say about that is something Iris Murdoch, you know, the great 20th century English novelist, she said every book should have something for everyone in it. And nature can't belong to the experts, can it?
No.
Nature has got to be saved from the experts. And so, so that was certainly my motivation for people as ignorant as me to enjoy reading about it.
Well, you grew up with seabirds, and I want to talk to you about the Shant Isles. They're in the Hebrides, and you used to go there with your father. Talk to me about that experience.
Yes, well, these are three very small islands in the middle of the sea, about 15 miles from the nearest inhabited place, and very rough wild seas, which my father, a great romantic, bought when he was 19. His grandmother had died, and she'd left him £1,200. And his mother, my father's mother, my grandmother, saw an advertisement in the paper saying, "Islands for sale,
£1,200,
early lambs, sea caves, seabirds." And so he went there for a day and bought them. That was in 1937. And they became a sort of a funny kind of heartland for the whole family. This very remote, very difficult, very, very unserviced place. You know, no electricity, no phone, no running water, no loo of any kind. But we all came to think of them as sort of the place that mattered, really. And when I was 21, rather a long time ago now, he gave them to me.
Wow.
Saying, this is a young man's place. And when my eldest son was 21, my eldest child was 21, I gave them to him too. So they no longer belong to me. But they are magical, and anyone can go and stay there if they want to. We have a website called www.shantisles.net, and you can just book in to stay. You've got to get yourself there. You've got to know how to survive in a rough place, and for free.
Wow. Talk to me about this book, because this book seems to be having originated in that childhood experience that you kept following up for. Every chapter follows a different seabird, a fulmar, puffin, kittiwake, which is a kind of gull, a gull itself, herring gull or great blackback gull, guillemot, which we call muir here, cormorant and shag, which we have cormorants here, shearwaters, which anybody who's taken a whale watch in the middle of summer off of Massachusetts has seen shearwaters, gannets, which are passed by us in fall and spring, the great auk and razorbill, and albatross, which people here rarely see albatross, but I've seen enough of them. When you talk about that group of birds, you're talking about a group of birds that exist in three elements. They are masters of the air and the sea. They may not do as well as on land, some of them, but they really are masters of three elements.
Well, they are. I mean, they're masters of the air. The great flyers. You know that albatrosses fly 5 million miles around the world in their lifetime. And, the shearwaters, even fledged, you know, their first months of life travel from remote European headlands and islands like those all the way to South America. On their first journey in life, they would travel 10,000 miles. Anyway, I became entranced by these things, as you say, when I was a child. And I've always loved them and have always assumed that they are rather a constant and fixed part of the world as it is, almost the best part of the world that I know. And the book was really motivated by a dawning recognition, maybe 7-8 years ago, starting to read the scientific literature, that these great and wonderful creatures were on the way out, and that the seabirds of the world as a whole have dropped in number by something like 60% in 50 years, 60, 70. It's very difficult to count seabirds, so the figures are always rough, but the trend is unmistakable. And so really the book is about the absolute wonder and giftedness of these creatures now, and the fate that is waiting for them, that's hanging over them now, of disappearance in many parts of the world.
There's a concept that follows you throughout this book, and it's interesting because I've read his original paper on this, and I want to talk about this first. The idea of Umwelt.
Well, Umwelt is, in German, it just means the surrounding world, even the environment, in German for environment. But the great original thinker called Jakob von Uexküll, who was a German from the Baltic, from Estonia, in the late 19th and early 20th century, who became very fascinated by the way in which marine organisms lived and ended up, in fact, training dogs in a German zoo, maintained, really for the first time, that it's a kind of Kantian philosophical idea, if you like, that the only world we know is the world that our senses tell us about. And so we human beings, do not know an objective world. We know the world that our senses inform us of. And so the implication of that, thinking more broadly, is that every creature on Earth has its Umwelt, its surrounding world, its world shaped by its senses. And there's no one can make no assumption is Uexküll's core point. One can make no assumption that our way of understanding the world is in any way superior to the ways that others can. And so, you know, how would we do if we just fledged, we just crawled out of our nappies and someone said to us, okay, fly to Rio now, please? It wouldn't go so well.
I remember reading a paper by him. I think it was my introduction to ethology class at university. And it was the first time I heard the idea of Umwelt, but it really stuck with me for my entire life that he illustrated, as a matter of fact, what an owl's world would look like. And it really is a different idea. And that's what you try to do in this book. You take each of the seabirds and through your writing, present the reader with an idea of how their world exists for them.
Exactly. I mean, people or science is changing now. But science for a long time has been very alarmed by the idea of an anthropomorphic view of animals. That somehow by imputing intelligence or motive or sensitivity or even shyness and boldness to wild creatures, you are somehow seeing them through a human lens or through human gauze, if you like. But the von Uexküll idea is so good, it turns that on its head. It says, why do you think that the scientific, which is essentially an economic view of creatures, you know, you'll do this to get this income and this degree of survival and so on. Why do you think that is somehow applicable to every other creature on Earth? Every other creature knows about, for example, the need to raise its kin or to make a good pair bond, as people say, rather technically. I like to say marriage in between births. And so that whole fear of the anthropomorphic is what I wanted to set aside and say, in fact, treat us all as subjects of zoomorphism. They're all animals. Be zoomorphic. That could be the motto at the head of the book.
Let's talk about it. We can't do this book justice, obviously, in the short time that we have, but let's talk about a few of the species. I want to start out by talking about fulmars. Fulmar is we see often during major nor'easters off our coast. They superficially, I think if people who weren't birders looked at them, they would think they sort of look like gulls, but in fact, they belong to a great group of birds that are affectionately known as tube noses.
Yes, the tube nose is a horrible term for them, isn't it? But they have this strange tube. The petrels are in it, the shearwaters are in it, and the albatross is a cousin to it. And the thing, the quality which all of those tube noses share is an absolute mastery of ocean navigation.
Oh my God!
But people have been following fulmars from the University of Aberdeen in northeast Scotland, Orkney, and the putting these new trackers, these GPS trackers on them, and their feats of life, really, their life feats. Flabbergasted the scientists when they got these trackers back. That even fulmars that are sitting on the nest and sitting on the nest with their partner. Their partner goes off, they sit on the nest, partner returns, and they go off themselves. And during that nesting absence, even of, it might be something like 12, 14 days absence, fulmars from North Scotland travel to the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, to two-thirds of the way to you, to fish with this incredibly rich, turbulent bit of the North Atlantic Ridge called the Charlie Gibbs Fracture Zone, which is one of the kind of four important places for North Atlantic sea life. Fish there, absorb the nutrients from hidden fish that they've been catching, fly back with it, and then chuck it off for the kid.
Oh, my God.
And it's just, it's magisterial, I think, that they understand. They understand how the winds work. They understand how low pressure systems work. They can navigate across uncharted ocean. They can return to places they know well. They can recognize parts of the European coastline. You know, if they arrive too far south on the coast of Ireland, they can make their way back up home to Orkney and so on. And it's just these are the constituents of an umwelt of which we as human beings have really no conception at all.
The first time I saw breeding fulmars, I'd always seen them far off our coast. And by the way, that's the way to see a fulmar, is out in a wild ocean, and you see them sort of zipping in between these wave troughs. I was on the Isle of Honda off the coast of Scotland, and I climbed to the top of a cliff, and I looked down, and there were all these fulmars sitting on these little ledges.
Yeah.
And it was amazing to me. I mean, it just blew my mind.
Well, it's odd, isn't it? Because obviously, until this paper, this extraordinary track out to the Mid-Atlantic region back, was published, I think, in 2014 or something. And until I read that, I'd seen them as sort of charming, interesting things. They got this revolting, sticky gunk that they can spit out at enemies and so on. And you see them playing on a cliffside in the wind, and there is clearly an absolute ease and swank. I don't know if that's an American.
That's right.
But just a kind of total ability and subtlety in their flying. And I hadn't guessed until then that all I was seeing was the absolute iceberg tip of what they were. And that's what's magic about this modern technology. You know, it reveals the depths of these lives.
Now, in many cases, these seabirds interact with humans, often negatively. But sometimes it's interesting the way that you write about how different human groups have utilized these seabirds. And in the case of the fulmar, there are the people who live on St. Kilda. And talk to me about, I mean, their culture, fulmars are a big part of it.
Yes, I mean, no longer. The people on St. Kilda, as you know, were taken off at their own request in 1930.
Right.
But before that, because Yeah, it's way out in the Atlantic. It's 40 miles west of the westernmost other Scottish island. They had very little to rely on, and they needed the seabirds. And when the seabirds returned in the spring, or in fact, Fulmer's come a bit earlier, but when most of the birds returned in the spring, it was like, or literally like manna from heaven. It was literally like protein suddenly arriving in their lives. And so they developed a whole culture. The wonderful St. Kilda songs about the Fulmer, the extraordinary sort of derring do escapades going down the huge 1,000-foot cliffs on St. Kilda to go and gather chicks and grown Fulmers. And they use them for everything. They use the oil as a kind of medication. They use, obviously, the feathers to stuff mattresses and pillows. They ate the oil. They ate the flesh of the birds. They you mix the oil with porridge, something I've never tried. But you can imagine, unbelievably nutritious. And careful about it, too, about not to, you know, like many traditional societies, not to overexploit this unbelievably precious resource. And so there were a lot of traditional rules on when you could begin to take them, how many each family could take them, and so on.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is award-winning writer Adam Nicholson. And we're talking about his book, The Seabird's Cry, The Lives and Loves of the Planet's Great Ocean Voyagers. Adam, I want to get back to navigating over the ocean, because you have a great section when you talk about shearwaters, about gradually deciphering how they are finding their way in the using Manx shearwaters. Manx shearwaters are seen here. We have four regular species of shearwaters that we see. It's the smallest one that's around here. But what was amazing is how they started doing homing, like you would use homing pigeons. They started doing homing experiments with Manx shearwaters. And some of those places where they were released were amazing.
They were. It's very fine, eccentric, pioneer seabird man, Ronald Lockley, in the 20s and 30s. And he rented a small island off the west coast of Wales, so it was full of shearwaters. And began, as everyone was at that stage, with ringing experiments, and so you call it banding experiments. He banded thousands of shearwaters and then waited for the rings to come back, to be sent back. But it's an incredibly clumsy means of understanding a bird's life. Someone said, you know, judging how a bird lives by band recoveries is like understanding the life of a city from its murder statistics. It was a great line. But anyway, he then, as you say, started on more elaborate experiments. His absolute climax was that he sent two of them by air with a friend of his to Venice, in the Adriatic, the other side of the bulk of the European continent. And they were released there in the Venetian Lagoon. One was never seen again. And one, 12 days later, was found back in its burrow in West Wales. 12 days later. And Lockley, of course, didn't know, had it gone all the way down Italy through the Mediterranean and through the Straits of Gibraltar and back up across the Atlantic, or had it actually flown over land? And how did it know? How on earth did it know? Oh, and the God. Other extraordinary thing about that bird arriving back in its burrow was that it was absolutely glossy with health and well-being, as if no stress had been imposed on it at all. It was completely full. It had eaten well a fish somewhere. So, yeah, okay, you can send me to Venice if you like, but I'll be back in my burrow 12 days later.
Well, eventually, they actually released them in Boston, and they get back to their burrow.
And he sent one over to Boston, a pair, and one died, I'm afraid, on the way, or I think on arrival. And the other one that was sent off from Logan, is it, in Boston?
Yep.
It was sent off, and it arrived back in West Wales, what, 3,000 miles away, before the letter announcing it had been released. Which is triumphant, isn't it? That's an Umwelt story. You know,
oh my.
You can arrange your postal systems if you like, but I'll fly home.
Well, we're going to run out of time, but I want to make sure we talk about this. One of the things they've been figuring out how shearwaters are finding their way is by smell.
Amazingly. Well, it's a very, very good experiment done by, I mean, superficially a rather a cruel experiment, but a very, very revelatory one by an Italian seabird scientist. And she released a whole group of shearwaters 500 miles away from their nest sites in the southern part of the North Atlantic, so west coast of Africa, a rather windless place, or a place of very fluky winds, the horse latitudes. And she divided her shearwaters in three. One lot she did nothing to at all. One lot she put a little box to their heads with little magnets tumbling around it, so the birds would be in constantly evolving magnetic field. And one she temporarily disabled with a spray their sense of smell. And the ones she'd done nothing to went pretty well straight home. The ones who had these magnets in a box on their heads also went pretty well straight home. But the ones whose sense of smell she disabled were totally lost. They circled round and round and round the northeast Atlantic, up almost into the Bay of Biscay, off the west coast of France, Portugal, Spain, just looking for what home was, because without a sense of smell, they couldn't know where it was. And the interesting thing is, there's no wind blowing from their nest to where they'd been released. So it wasn't like one of those gravy advertisements where the kids, you know, follow a plume, delicious smell. They knew the Atlantic by what it smelt like where they were. They had a smell map of the ocean. I mean, people are continuing to try and understand this, because no one quite gets how any bird can do that. How do you know where you are by what that bit of ocean smells like?
Part of the problem nowadays is that one of the smells that they recognize is dimethyl sulfide, also known as DMS. And the problem is their prey items give off a smell of dimethyl sulfide, but plastics also give off a smell of dimethyl sulfide.
That's right. In fact, it's given off by the food that their prey is eating. When phytoplankton, the plant plankton, is crushed, it gives off this DMS plume. And birds can detect it as incredibly low concentrations. But as you say, if plastic floats for a while in the ocean, it too absorbs enough from the ocean, and I don't know whether people understand this mechanism yet, that it gives off a plume of DMS. And so as a result, all seabirds, it's now becoming clear, all seabirds ingest plastic. Every single stomach of a dead seabird opened up has plastic in it. And one of the difficulties of that is that the plastic sits in the stomach. It can't be ejected in any way. And so the birds literally become filled with plastic and starve, because no food can get into their gut and into their system. So in that way, plastic directly kills seabirds.
And we just have a few minutes left, and I want to talk about this, because one of the things you address at the end of the book is all the dangers that seabirds face at this time. We talked about plastics, but one of the greatest ones is climate change. Do we have any clue about how global climate change is going to affect these birds that seem to have completely different world maps of and how they operate than we do?
Well, one of the problems with being a seabird is that you can't lay an egg on the sea. not because an egg won't float, but because an egg won't breathe in water, and the chick in the egg has to breathe. It needs access to air. And so seabirds need land breeding places. And, of course, of their nature, land breeding places are fixed. But if you just dump global warming into that equation, global warming, of course, has had, is having, and will continue to have for decades, an enormous effect on the circulation system of the atmosphere-ocean system. And so what happens is that ocean currents change. Ocean currents move from where they were. The currents that carry the fish, if they become too warm themselves, then stop being sympathetic to the kind of plankton on which the fish feed. And so the plankton goes, the fish goes, the fish go, and there is nowhere for these breeding seabirds to fish, to feed themselves and to feed their young before they're fledged. And so it's that coming together of radical systematic change to the oceans, allied to the rigidity and fixity of seabird breeding places, that is really, really dangerous. And in many parts of the North Atlantic, in Norway, in Iceland, in Shetland, in the north of the British Isles, there have been truly catastrophic declines in puffins, in kittiwakes in particular, in guillemots in some places, simply because that mix of change plus necessary rigidity means the end of a working system. So it's a very alarming. Sorry, Churchill's ringing in the background here.
Well, I want to recommend this book highly. It'll open the worlds of these birds to you, to the readers out there. And it's a wonderful book, and it'll hopefully grow your appreciation of these birds and get you motivated to do something about this. My guest tonight is award-winning writer Adam Nicholson. And we've been talking about his book, The Seabird's Cry, The Lives and Loves of the Planet's Great Ocean Voyagers. Adam, it's been a real pleasure.
Thanks so much, Mark. Thank you.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.